Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today, the UK Parliament rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan for the third time by a vote of 334 to 286. This means that Britain is closer to leaving the EU in just a few weeks without a deal. So what does this all mean? Joining us to discuss coverage is Eric Reguli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail based in Rome, Italy. Since 2007, when Eric moved to Europe, he's been covering the economy. He's now in London covering the political crisis gripping the UK in the aftermath of the Brexit vote. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back.
Great to have you. And I'm so glad that we asked you to come on today because of this vote. So, Eric, can you just give us the overview? What exactly did the UK Parliament vote on today?
Well, today was supposed to be the big day. Today, March 29th, was supposed to be Britain's last day in the European Union. This was a date set a long, long time ago. Remember, the referendum was in June 2016. So the mood here is toxic. Theresa May, the Prime Minister, has failed in her third attempt, to get her deal through Parliament. She's lost all control of the Conservative Party, lost all control of her cabinet. The opposition Labour Party has, by and large, voted against her. So her Brexit deal is dead, and there is a very good chance now that, barring a new deal, the Britain will crash out on April 12th. Now, why April 12th? That's the deadline that the European Union in Brussels has given Britain to either get a new deal or leave, which is a crash out, which would be economically catastrophic.
What is in store for the future of Theresa May? Because it seems like she tried to convince her colleagues to vote yes, saying that she would leave Parliament, but they voted no. So what's in store for Theresa May?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, I think she's done. She has no credibility left. But what she did was actually perverse. She said, look, if we win the vote, in other words, if her Brexit scenario were to have won today, which it didn't, it failed a couple hours ago, then she would step down. But she said, I'm not stepping down if I lose. So which is, isn't it supposed to be the other way around? So she has the scenario where she was rewarded for failure and not rewarded for success. So in theory, she doesn't have to step down now because her vote didn't win. I mean, as perverse as it sounds. But having said that, she has no control of her party. The unofficial race has started already to replace her. There must be 15 names. Some of them you might know, like Boris Johnson. Most others you wouldn't know, vying to replace her. But the other question is there going to be a general election first? Who knows?
So, Eric, can you lay out what's in these different deals, these different Brexit deals? What's really at stake here?
Well, it's so complicated, but to simplify, it's the visions are a hard Brexit, which the hard Brexiteers want. What does that mean? That means leaving with no trade deal with the European Union, no customs union, nothing. You start from zero. But their argument is that Britain will be truly free from the European yoke and will be able to negotiate trade deals with whoever it wants. In other words, 100% full sovereignty. It's sort of a romantic vision, which doesn't seem quite realistic. The other vision is what they call a soft Brexit, where Britain would be technically out of the EU, but would retain some ties. So a soft Brexit would mean that Britain would stay in the customs union, the European customs union, for example. Now, why a soft Brexit? That's designed to keep the British economy, which is an exporting economy, intact. I mean, so it would still be able to trade with the European Union. So those are, it's either a soft Brexit and variations thereof, or a hard Brexit. Theresa May actually was endorsing a soft Brexit, as was the Labour Party.
And remind us what happened back in 2016, Eric. 51.9% of voters said yes, they wanted to leave the EU. But then we learned that a lot of people were really confused about what they were voting for exactly. So can you lay that out for us?
Sure, yeah. David Cameron was the prime minister then, and he was facing a revolt from the hardcore Eurosceptics in the Conservative Party. So he did a really moronic thing. You know, Rose, referendums are always highly risky. Why? Because the question on the referendum is not what people vote for. They sometimes use it as a protest vote, and that's what happened in this case. So it went 52-48 in favor of Brexit, but you can't say that the 52% of Brits actually fully endorse Brexit. Some of them are just, you know, annoyed at the government, annoyed at how the middle class was evaporating, annoyed at the wealth divide. So it became a form of protest vote. I actually don't believe that 52% of Britons actually want to leave the European Union. It's somewhat less. Certainly, there's a hardcore. So in order to satisfy a parochial problem, a problem within the Conservative Party, David Cameron, he gambled. The gamble went against him, and now he's facing, you know, the blow-up of Britain. I mean, don't forget that if Britain does leave, Scotland wants to stay in the EU, so does Northern Ireland. So you could actually see the breakup of the United Kingdom as well.
Wow, because that would be huge. We're talking about issues of border. We're talking about major issues of trade.
Yeah, sure. But, I mean, it really is an existential crisis for Britain, because I'm going to guess. I mean, I don't know, because anyone who does know what's going to happen between now and April 12th is lying. No one really knows what's going to happen. But let's say, for the sake of argument, it's a 50% chance that Britain crashes out because it can't get a new deal. Then what happens? Well, you're going to have an election, new leader, but what really is going to happen is Scotland going to leave the United Kingdom? Because they voted very heavily in favor of Europe in the 2016 election, as did Northern Ireland, right? Northern Ireland doesn't want a hard border between it and the Republic of Ireland to the south. So you could see, I mean, if you go back 3 years, what David Cameron did is he threw not only a grenade into Europe, he threw a big grenade into the United Kingdom. In a year or two, the UK may be England and Wales, and that's it.
We're speaking today with Eric Reguli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail, about what is happening in the UK. The Parliament just rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan for the third time, and this means that Britain is closer, possibly, to leaving the EU in just 2 weeks without a deal. If you have any questions for Eric, we'd love to hear from you. We're also going to talk about media coverage, how people in the UK and the EU are responding to all of this. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Eric, can you lay out the differences of opinion among the main rival camps inside the UK? Can you tell us who the big players are and what they are asking for?
There's so many different views. Are you talking from the press point of view, or
let's first talk about Parliament. Within Parliament, and for those of us in the US who don't know how the UK Parliament works, can you also, I know these are big questions, but can you lay out how that works?
The British Parliament's like, well, the Canadian Parliament. I'm a Canadian. I know that doesn't help very much, but there are two main parties, Theresa May's Conservatives and the opposition Labour Party. The Labour Party tends to be more socialist, more left leaning. The Conservatives tend to be neoliberal, in other words, regulation light, low taxes, more akin to the U.S. Republican Party. The problem in this parliament, Rose, is that the Conservatives do not have a majority. They rely on another party, which is a Northern Ireland party called the Democratic Union Party. And so the agreement was, when Theresa May called an election two years ago, in which she lost her majority, she's relying on this third party. But this third party, here's the wrinkle, this third party has revolted against her. Today it voted against her Brexit deal, which is the main reason they lost today, other than, you know, most of the Labour Party didn't lose. There are fixed elections are don't really happen here. There could be an election called, you know, maybe in the autumn after a leadership race for the Conservative Party. So it doesn't have to be every 4 years. If once the main party loses its majority, all bets are off.
What are you hearing from leaders of the Labour Party?
Well, the Labour Party wants to go to an election. The leader is Jeremy Corbyn. He did very well in the 2017 election. They had a minority, and they still have a minority, but it's a much bigger minority than they had. More importantly, that they denied the Conservatives their majority because they picked up so many seats. Because, you know, Theresa May is so unpopular, so uncharismatic, and so ineffective, we now know. So he's champing at the bit for an election because he thinks he can win it. He probably could. My own view is that this has been such a shambles, Brexit, the way this has been handled. The reversals, the incompetence, the infighting, that I think the Conservatives, Theresa May's Conservatives, need, you know, a few years, maybe a decade in opposition. They need to rebuild, to reinvent themselves. They just can't keep going on. Now, having said that, Jeremy Corbyn is quite left-wing. He's probably too left-wing for the average Brit. But I still think Labour could win the next election, maybe with a minority government, but I think they could win very easily.
What about the main rival? I'm sorry, can you talk a little bit about the UK government and the EU? What is that conversation sounding like? What are the bones of contention there?
Well, that's a really good question. The European Union in Brussels has been consistent. And they really haven't played games as much as certain politicians here think that the EU's played games. The EUA does not want Britain to leave. They said that they really don't want the second biggest economy to leave. But at the same time, they said, look, if you're going to leave, leave. You can't cherry pick. You voted for Brexit. You're leaving, but you can't leave with and keep the bits you want, you know. Otherwise, that's not Brexit. And also, the EU is really worried that it could trigger a domino effect. Now, what do I mean by that? In other words, if the EU made it very easy for Britain to leave, why not Italy, which has a Eurosceptic government? Why not Greece? Why not Hungary, which has a really strong Eurosceptic government, or Poland? So they couldn't make it easy for Britain to leave. So they were quite inflexible. But, you know, I don't think they were playing games. I think they did the right thing. But here's the good thing for the EU. Many, many populist parties before Brexit were talking about, getting out of the EU. The coalition government in Italy, the new one, When they were campaigning last year in the Italian election, they were both campaigning about having referendums on European membership. That all talk has died. It's dead now. So all these populist Eurosceptic parties are still Eurosceptic. They're still populist, but guess what? They see the pain that Britain's going through to get out of the European Union. They're saying, no, thanks, forget it. We don't want to go through that. So that's sort of done, perversely, has done the EU a favor.
What is the media coverage on this like in the UK and the EU, Eric? Specifically looking at the social fabric of society, how this is affecting people, and just their expectations about what might come, especially when it comes to, you know, the economy, making ends meet, basic necessities. The Irish Times spoke with writers about what this would mean, and Amir McBride, who's a novelist, wrote, quote, "Well, this has all gone really well, hasn't it? Over the last 2 years, any hope of repairing the Brexit vote's damage to social cohesion in the UK has been completely trampled on. Homelessness is rife. Queues at food banks are growing ever longer. The NHS, the National Health System, is wondering how it can possibly cope once all the immigrants whose dedication and hard work makes its existence possible has been refused work permits. Mixed British and EU families are living in fear of being broken up. Young people have no idea whether or not they'll be able to study abroad." I mean, she goes on and on about how this has affected people already.
Well, she's absolutely right. I mean, that's what's happening here. It is completely divided Britain. There's, you know, everyone's got a different point of view. England, which is, you know, the biggest country in the United Kingdom, but not London, but England as a whole is pro-Brexit. Scotland and Northern Ireland are not. Wales is pro-Brexit. So you've got this division. When you're pro-Brexit, you're sovereigntist, you're largely anti-migrant. So there is that tensions. The press is divided too. You've got the Telegraph, which is, you know, a huge paper, which is pro-Brexit. The Guardian, which is, you know, very much anti-Brexit. So there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of division here. There are millions of EU citizens in Britain, most of them in London working in financial services. They have no idea what's going to happen to them. But the bigger question is the economy. There is absolutely no certainty among industry and business whether Britain in 2 weeks, let alone 2 years, in 2 weeks to be part of the EU. And the economy is going south now. I mean, house prices are falling. Car companies are pulling out. Honda decided to pull out. Honda had its biggest European factory was in England, and it's decided to pull out. Now it denies that Brexit has anything to do with it, but we all know they're just being sweethearts about it. It had everything to do with it. Nissan in northeast England is already cutting back. So Brexit is going to really help deindustrialize this country, and that annoys people who are pro-Brexit, because it's an expensive country and it costs a lot of money to live here, and if jobs are disappearing, it's going to hurt everyone.
What about her comments about homelessness? She says it's rife. Queues at the food banks are growing ever longer.
Yeah, well, I don't know, Rose, really how much that's got to do with Brexit, but you know, that's austerity. You know, the Prime Minister and his regime before Theresa May, so that'd be David Cameron and his cronies, the financial crisis of 2008 really hurt Britain as much as any other country in Europe. The banks had to be nationalized. I mean, it was a disaster here. Unemployment way up, but they recovered fairly quickly. But still, 10 years later, 11 years later now, the standard of the wealth effect has not come back. Middle class incomes are still either at or below where they were in 2008. So a lot of this had to do with austerity. So you're getting a lot more homeless. You're getting the National Health Service under much more strain because the money is just not there. And this is why there's such resentment against the Conservative Party for their austerity packages, as there was in Greece, as there is in Italy.
Today we're joined by Eric Regulli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. Eric is in London covering the political crisis gripping the UK in the aftermath of the Brexit vote, and he's going to be with us for about five or so more minutes. If you have any questions for Eric about what is happening, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Eric, we have an email from Ruby who says, "Was it a lack of political skill, negotiating skills? What is your opinion? And wasn't Theresa May against Brexit in the first place? How can Parliament not follow the will of the people?"
Okay, yeah, there's three questions here. Yes, Theresa May did not vote in favor of Brexit in 2016, though she was, since then, she's flipped. She was always, she never campaigned hard saying that Britain should stay. I mean, she was really weak on that. Since she became prime minister, she seems to have flipped, and she promised, her opening line was after, when she became prime minister, was Brexit means Brexit, and she was determined to fulfill the will of the people. The will of the people were 52% are voted. But, you know, her party is completely divided, and that's how she's lost control of her party, how she lost control of her cabinet. I mean, she had, I think, today she had 10 of her own cabinet ministers vote against her in her third vote. So this is why she's on her way out. So even the Conservative Party is utterly divided on this. There are many Conservative members realize that being in the EU is the best way to keep the economy intact.
Well, thank you for that question, Ruby. And Eric, I mean, how did this process get so messed up, given that it has been 3 years now?
I mean, that's the key question. I mean, isn't it amazing, Rose, that almost 3 years later, more than 1,000 days, there is still no deal in Britain? I mean, it's been completely wasted. In the meantime, look at all the legislation that's been ignored. I mean, it's three lost years. It's probably going to be four or five lost years by the time they figure this out. How did it happen? Because by and large, most of the members of parliament, and there's about 600 of the members of parliament in the Conservatives, the opposition Labour, and the smaller parties like the Northern Ireland Party, most members of parliament, think of them as congressmen and women, are against Brexit. Even though the population voted 52% against, in favor of Brexit, does not mean 52% of the members of parliament were in favor of Brexit. They weren't. Each party and members within each party, all of them had different ideas on what Brexit meant. Soft Brexit, hard Brexit, crash out, somewhere in between. It was just a mess, and it just got so tangled that no one could actually define what Brexit meant. And that's where it went off the rails. There was no united front in any party.
So what do you expect to happen in the next 2 weeks? Do you think that there's another chance for a referendum?
Oh, God, it's so hard to say. I mean, any prediction is going to be wrong, but I'll make one anyway. I will guess. I don't feel very strongly on this, but if someone put a gun to my head and said, what's going to happen, I'm going to say that Theresa May is going to go back to Brussels and beg for a year extension and hope that Brussels gives them an extension. They probably will, even though France is against it, the idea. And then they're going to go, I don't think they'll be in a referendum first. I think then they'll go into a leadership race to replace Theresa May. And then you go into a general election. A leadership race would not be determined until the early autumn. So the soonest there could be an election is probably late autumn, winter. So almost, you know, let's say 9-10 months from now. The question is, will the new leader be any, Tory leader be any better than Theresa May? And, you know, it looks like a pretty unimpressive gang of characters looking for a job so far.
Well, Eric, as always, thank you for your reporting, and we'll try to catch up with you and bring you back on in the next 2 weeks to find out what happens.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Rose. Great fun.
Thank you, Eric. That is Eric Reguli. He's European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. He's based in Rome, Italy, but right now he's in London covering the political crisis gripping the UK in the aftermath of today's Brexit vote. The UK Parliament rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's plan for the third time by a vote of 334 to 286. This means that Britain is closer to leaving the EU if a plan is not agreed upon in just 2 weeks. So we'll continue to follow this story. And you can find Eric's reporting at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will be joined by Mark Joseph Stern. He covers courts for Slate. We're going to talk about Donald Trump's mostly white male conservative judges and what this means for very important issues like abortion and guns for decades to come. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call on the phone by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Reminder that Your Call is among the podcasts we offer. Go to klw.org/subscribe to learn more. And on Fridays, we bring you further roundups of the week news with 1A coming up at 11, and then on the media at 6, and left, right, and center at 7. All ahead here on Local Public Radio, KLW.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about media coverage of Donald Trump's mostly white male conservative judges. According to Vice, his judicial picks, many of them, are more conservative than those appointed by George W. Bush. His federal appeals court picks are very young, which means that Donald Trump will leave an imprint on cases on issues like the environment, guns, and abortion for decades to come, because these are lifetime appointments. So what do we need to know about these judges and how their decisions will affect our communities and our lives? Today, we're joined by Mark Joseph Stern. Mark covers courts and the law for Slate. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me back on.
Well, it's always great to have you, Mark. You know, in the past, well, let's just say couple of years, I mean, the majority of the media and social media have really turned into kind of like a central command for Donald Trump's daily outbursts. There's been so much good journalism, but it's just so hard to get traction on really any story. And one of the areas that needs so much more attention, and you cover this on a regular basis, is all of these vacancies on the courts. And Donald Trump is filling them incredibly fast.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I would say that when it's 2065 or 2070 and we are still seeing laws struck down by judges appointed by Donald Trump, I do suspect the future generations will wonder why we spent such relatively little time talking about these crucially important appointments and sort of let them fall away in our coverage of this administration.
Wow. 2065 or 2070?
That is the track record of many judges appointed in the past. There are still judges who were appointed to the bench by LBJ who are serving today. So if you do the math, it seems, if not overwhelmingly likely, then quite probable that these guys and a few women will still be serving for a very long time. Like you said, Trump is focusing on young people, people in their 30s who are going to hold these appointments for so very long, develop a huge body of jurisprudence, and frankly, develop a great deal of power because one of Donald Trump's appointees' goals is to actually aggrandize the power of the federal judiciary, often at the expense of Congress and even the president.
Okay, so before we dive in and talk about who these people are, we say these are Donald Trump's judges, but so many people are bringing in lists of judges. We did a show about the Federalist Society. I think you may have been on that. But who really has his ear when it comes to the judges he's appointing and choosing?
Right. So the most important voice, I think almost everyone agrees, is Leonard Leo, who is the head of the president's, of the Federalist Society, who has the president's ear when it comes to judges, in part because Leo helped Trump craft that list of potential Supreme Court nominees that was released during the campaign. That list shored up so much support for Donald Trump among establishment Republicans who care about the courts but might not have a taste for Trump's particular political style. Trump realizes that Leo gave him an amazing gift in the form of that list, and he has since trusted Leo to keep pushing through these names of promising, often intellectually adventurous, conservative attorneys who are connected to the Federalist Society, who have already sort of sworn their loyalty to the Federalist Society, who have very clear ideas about the law, and who are basically going to help to further the Republican agenda on the courts, whether or not that's what they believe they're doing.
Mark, would you say this is one of the main reasons why more Republicans are not standing up to Trump? People keep saying, why are Republicans just going along with what he's doing? Well, one major reason is look at the courts.
Absolutely. And I mean, to go back to my earlier example, I think it's absolutely possible that in, 2065, an elderly Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez passes Medicare for All, and then a Trump-appointed judge strikes it down on day one. Republicans are looking into the future apprehensively. They see demographic change. They see a kind of blue wall forming in the suburbs, and they recognize that the judiciary is going to be their bastion of power, and it's going to be their own firewall against a ton of progressive legislation that's going to flood through both the states and Congress in the coming years and decades. So I do think there are a lot of Republicans out there who are on the fence about Trump. Maybe they just don't like the guy. Maybe they even hate him, but they love the people Trump is putting on the federal bench, and they're willing to hold their nose and vote for him again because they think the quality of his federal judicial appointments are just so high.
Right. So let's take a step back here, because you are doing excellent coverage on this, and if you search for it, you can find good stories. The Washington Post has had many. It deserves so much more attention in the media. Tell us about the vacancies that have happened under Trump and how fast he has moved to fill them, and how, in many ways, it's kind of unprecedented. He's moved, in some cases, faster than his predecessors.
Oh, he's moved in all cases faster
all cases,
than his predecessors,
okay.
Actually. He has now beat where Obama was on appointing appellate judges toward the start of Obama's second term, and Trump is only just past the two-year mark in office. There are a couple reasons for that. Number one, Republicans were quite savvy about blocking Obama's nominees. A lot of them languished in the Senate for years. The Senate never took any action. Republicans turned in blue slips to prevent Obama from nominating judges who happened to be from conservative states. And the overall effect of this was a judiciary at near crisis point. When Trump took office, there were more than 100 vacancies in the federal judiciary, not just the famous Supreme Court vacancy, but dozens and dozens on appellate courts and in federal district courts. There were very, very senior 90-year-old district court judges essentially being called back into duty, sometimes to serve pretty vast geographic expanses, because there was just no judicial backlog that was going to be cleared anytime soon. Trump came in and said, let's fill these seats instantly. And that's what he did with the help of the Senate. The Senate has been controlled by Republicans throughout Trump's term, and Republican senators were bolstered by the Democrats' abolition of the filibuster for judicial nominees. So Trump's friends in the Senate essentially began on day one pushing through these names as quickly as they could. They rejected Democrats' blue slips. They changed a bunch of the rules to fact-track the process. And the upshot is that all of these vacancies, or almost all of them, were filled within 2 years. Now more are opening up, and Trump is filling them about as fast as they can open up. So this is just an extremely efficient process. I think, frankly, from a bureaucratic perspective, there's a lot to admire about it, even if we don't appreciate or support the results.
Let's talk about the power of these courts. You gave a great example. Let's say an AOC in 30 years, let's say 5 years, 10 years, passes Medicare for All. One of these judges can block it and say it's unconstitutional. But can you give us some other examples and just why these courts are so important? We've done shows with you before about how the Supreme Court gets so much attention, but in many cases, I mean, these courts, they get far more cases than the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. And it's important to remember that until Congress or the Supreme Court puts limits on this practice, single federal district courts are empowered to issue nationwide global injunctions that block the enforcement of a law everywhere. So they hold a lot of power. To give one example aside from Medicare for All, H.R. 1 is the Democrats' sort of landmark elections reform bill. One of the sections of H.R. 1, which has already passed the House, would force every state to adopt an independent redistricting commission. I think it is quite likely that if H.R. 1 ever passes, and it will if Democrats ever take the Senate back, I think, a federal district court will step in and immediately block that part of the law. There are also campaign finance limitations in the law. I think those will be put on hold hours after the law is passed. A few other examples, any kind of energy regulation, any kind of clean Green New Deal style regulation that expands federal power to regulate businesses and to regulate what states permit within their own borders, those laws are going to get blocked. There's just no question in my mind, because the Supreme Court's jurisprudence here is very malleable and a little hazy. It's a perfect kind of jurisprudence for lower courts to manipulate to prevent Democrats from basically ever passing anything again.
Wow. I'm thinking about a couple recent cases. Let's see, I'm looking at a Vox piece back in August. A federal judge blocked the Trump administration from deporting any of the reunited families who were separated under the administration's, quote, zero tolerance prosecution policy. I was thinking about the judges who stepped in and blocked the Muslim ban. I mean, this just speaks to how important these judges are. And in many cases, most of us have never heard of them before.
Yes. And just last night, in fact, a judge here in D.C. stepped in to block the Trump administration's efforts to skirt the Affordable Care Act,
right,
and allow plans that do not provide the minimum protection guarantees that the ACA requires. Now, that judge, who is actually a professor of mine in law school, is a very conservative George W. Bush appointee, but even he was able to sort of read the text of the law and recognize, hey, this is not what Congress was going for. The Trump administration cannot ignore federal statutes. I think there are fewer and fewer judges like that getting appointed by Trump. There are fewer judges who are genuinely independent, who are sort of scholarly and nonpartisan and have a deep interest in applying the law as written. You have more judges who have been sort of indoctrinated with what I call the Federalist Society dogma. And I recognize that the Federalist Society rejects that description of its program. But these are people who, many starting on day one in law school, began to talk about this very specific concept of how the Constitution works, of how statutes should be interpreted, who believe that things like the ACA are totally unconstitutional and have to be blocked and basically destroyed at any cost. So you have judges who are coming in with so many more biases, and even if they aren't outright corrupt, and I don't think most of them are, they do have these profound and deep prejudices toward, frankly, progressive legislation that I think we're going to see really manifest themselves in the courts just blocking every Democrat's move from here on out.
We're talking today with Mark Joseph Stern. He covers courts and the law for Slate. You can find his stories at yourcallradio.org. We're talking about Donald Trump's mostly white male conservative judges. And these decisions will be with us for decades to come, because many of these judges are lifetime appointments. If you have any questions for Mark about this, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255 or email yourcall@kalw.org. Marks, can you tell us about some of these young judges? I have read that they are anti-gay marriage, they are anti-choice. Name the social issue, and most of them are against it. I mean, when you're talking about rights for LGBTQ people, when you're talking about rights for women, for people of color, where do they stand on these really important social issues? And then we'll talk about the environment and the economy.
Absolutely. So just to name one classic example, one of Trump's high-profile appointments to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is a relatively young guy named James Ho, who I think is very, very smart. And he has devoted his early months on the bench to essentially declaring war on every progressive Supreme Court decision that's ever been handed down. One of his very first decisions attacked abortion as, quote, a moral tragedy, and accused a lower court judge of manifesting anti-Christian bias because he issued an order on a Sunday. Judge Ho has also written that he doesn't think federal civil rights laws protect LGBTQ people. He's cast some doubt on the Supreme Court's marriage equality decision. He has written an extreme support of gun rights that would basically knock down almost every gun regulation on the books. And he is, I think, a great example of the kind of ideology many of these judges have, even if they aren't quite as willing to express it as he is. Those are just a few of the many, many issues where the judiciary is going to assert itself in a big way for the conservative side.
And how old is this guy?
I believe he's in his 40s.
Wow.
Which is a bit old for Donald Trump, actually, because so many of his appointments, like I said, are in their mid-30s, including Alison Rushing, who was put on the Fourth Circuit. Now, this is, I'm sure, a very intelligent young woman. Well, not so young anymore, but by Trump standards, you know, it's a sort of different ballgame. She used to work for Alliance Defending Freedom, which is an anti-gay, anti-trans organization that supports the criminalization of homosexuality, that opposes transgender children using the correct bathrooms in school, that opposes LGBTQ non-discrimination laws, and she worked for this group for a summer. She continued her involvement with the group. She gave speeches to it, including one speech in which she basically condemned and criticized one of the Supreme Court's marriage equality decisions. So, again, it's just no mystery what these judges think about these issues. They may try to hide it during their confirmations, but as soon as they get on the bench, their ideology comes out once again.
Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for taking my call. It's an excellent program, as usual, but I have a very simple question. I think you've answered it to some extent. These people are appointed for life, and they cannot be removed. But my question is this. How many people are already, many judges are already in the pipeline that have been appointed for years before? That's my question. Perhaps it's a hard one to answer. But I'm curious, because otherwise we're talking about really a judicial dictatorship.
Thank you, Max.
So basically, how many judges are in the pipeline to be appointed in the coming months and years? Is that the question?
Is that right, Max? I believe that's his question, especially
yeah,
we're talking about
the
lifetime appointments.
Right. So with the lifetime appointments, I mean, these judges, they are lined up for appointment from now pretty much until the end of time. There are lists being drawn up by the Federalist Society every single month, and they are going to the president, and the president is essentially affixing his signature and saying, do what you got to do. There are so many who are waiting in the wings because there's a massive backbench of basically Federalist Society fans who are ready to jump in and do their service. And I do think, I mean, I think dictatorship is taking it a little bit far, but this is why there are groups like PAC the Courts, which supports adding two liberal justices to the Supreme Court, because they believe that we are facing down a future in which the democratic branches of government in the states and in Congress just don't have room to act, because the judiciary is going to consolidate so much power and return us to an age when judges just sort of enforce conservative dogma and don't allow citizens to govern themselves.
Wow. Thank you, Max. Let's go next to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I can't think of anything more depressing than this show. I'm 80 years old, and I am glad I'm not going to be around much longer. You know, it's just it's making me so sick that I just don't know. You know, there's nothing we can do. I mean, from what this journalist has been saying, you know, he's just going on and on about all these horrible things that are happening and going to happen, and and we're, you know, we're powerless. And I'm not so sure we need to keep having these kinds of programs on the air. I mean, it's all very interesting.
Nancy, maybe if the media spent less time on Russia and Mueller and Trump's tweets,
maybe
you know, people could have done something about it. So
I'm, you know, but it's not, and it's just it's so depressing that it's very hard to get out of bed.
I get that. But I do think, you know, that encapsulates some of the reasons why the media doesn't spend time covering this stuff, right? It's not surprising. People don't want to hear the same depressing story about Trump's judges over and over and over again. Let me just provide a little bit of a silver lining here, which is that the federal courts are not the only courts in this country. Instead, every single state has its own judiciary. In many states, the people have control over that judiciary through judicial elections. And in a lot of states, we have seen Democrats and progressives reassert their control over state judiciaries by turning out for these elections, often in record numbers. So, for example, in North Carolina, the legislature has gone hog wild with these insane Republican bills, most notoriously HB2, the anti-trans bill. But the Republicans have basically taken control of the legislature indefinitely. Meanwhile, the North Carolina Supreme Court is 6-1 liberal because Democrats keep winning state Supreme Court elections. In Wisconsin, there's going to be a state Supreme Court election in April where Democrats have a chance to hold a liberal seat and then flip the court next year. California has a very progressive Supreme Court. So does Pennsylvania. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court recently struck down the state's gerrymandered congressional map and drew a new one that is much fairer to Democrats and creates more competitive elections. People who are really upset about the federal judiciary, they should be, but I don't think that they should just knock it out of bed in the morning, because there are these other courts that basically could use citizens' help to put some controls on Republican excesses. Often citizens can help directly by canvassing, campaigning, making donations, supporting certain candidates. And so it's not as if we're all just at the absolute mercy of this federal judicial so-called dictatorship, as an earlier caller put it. There is room for citizens to try to make change in their own states and improve conditions within their own state's boundaries, even if the federal courts are going astray.
Well, thank you for calling, Nancy. We feel your pain, and my comment wasn't toward you at all. It was just really frustration with the media and all of the airtime taken up by the tweets and Russia and Mueller, and when there's all these other very important issues to cover. So thank you, Nancy. We feel your pain. Let's go next to Ariana in San Francisco. Hi, Ariana. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I have a number of points just in response to the last caller as well as to the earlier segment. We're going through a universal pass-through conflict in which people who've had privilege and power have and continue to try to protect their power. And unfortunately, we've abused our power in this country. We've set up dictatorships and kangaroo courts and assassinated people all around the world. And now we're actually experiencing that firsthand, which is sort of like a karmic experience. But it's not to not. We have to learn through this process, and it's a process of consensus in which, like the EU and England and these countries that had colonial domination over other weaker countries, there is a reticence to learn how to share power and to be inclusive. And so the old order in which you see white men who've ruled in this way through the police, through vigilantes, and through creating laws that inflict hardship and injustice and gross economic disparity on people who don't have access to education or to even
Well, Arianna, sorry to cut you off. We're getting toward the end of the show, and I completely hear what you're saying, and we try our best to cover the various angles that you brought up there. But thank you for calling. And I hate to just switch gears quickly, but I have to because we're almost out of time, Mark. And you wrote a really great piece. Again, it's kind of depressing, but so, so important. You write, Trump's lower court judges are dismantling Roe, one terrible ruling at a time. And you point out that progressives spend a lot of time wondering about whether the Supreme Court will overturn Roe for good reason. But you write, the lower courts need not wait for Roe to go to dramatically limit access to abortion. They can effectively kill Roe by 1,000 cuts. And that's precisely what the Sixth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals did earlier this month, permitting Ohio to defund Planned Parenthood by saying that there's no 14th Amendment right to perform abortions. Can you quickly just give us a overview and catch us up on what's happening there?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, there's a revolt in the lower courts that are controlled by Republican appointees. You have a critical mass of judges and at least three federal appeals courts who are simply unwilling to enforce Roe and its progeny. So in the Sixth Circuit, the conservative appointees, including Trump's appointees, ruled that even though there's a federal constitutional right to abortion access, that that right somehow does not protect abortion providers, which flies in the face of Whole Woman's Health, the 2016 Supreme Court decision. So too did rulings out of the Fifth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit, which upheld these absurd trap laws that are designed to regulate abortion clinics out of existence. The Supreme Court said in Whole Woman's Health that those laws were unconstitutional, yet Texas, Louisiana, and Missouri passed really just identical versions of these laws, and now the courts are upholding them for some reason. It's not hard to guess what that reason is. It's that Brett Kavanaugh has replaced Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court, and savvy observers think there's now a 5-justice majority to overturn Roe. So the lower courts are not waiting for those justices to act. They are doing everything they can, and as Linda Greenhouse wrote in the New York Times yesterday, this is really a 5-alarm fire for abortion rights.
Wow. Well, we're going to have to do a show about that. And Mark, as hard as some of this is to hear, we're grateful for your reporting. It's so important and it deserves far more coverage. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me back on. Always a pleasure.
Mark Joseph Stern covers courts and the law for Slate. If you want to know what's going on with the courts, he's writing almost every day. You can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and send ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.